Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 936, The Making of Donald Trump, subtitled Top Banana Republic, Part 5. This is being recorded on December 1st of the year 2016. Since Trump's election, I have been reading much of the text of a very important and yet very short and well-written biography of Donald Trump called The Making of Donald Trump. It is authored by David K. C.A.Y. Johnston and was published in hardcover by Melville House, copyright by David Johnston in 2016. This book offers us, I think, a very good insight into what is going on, something I would characterize as the Caligulization of America, because we now have our very own Caligula roosting atop the increasingly soiled hen house that is the United States of America. Again, I have no financial dog in this fight. I get no money from the reading of this book, nor do any of the stations. I emphatically recommend that people get a hold of the book, read it, tell other people about it. It would make in this holiday season an excellent holiday gift for someone you know. The book itself serves, I think, as a very good chevron by which the disintegration of America's institutions could be measured, and frankly, I think a very good chevron or a very good balance in which the failure not only of this country's institutions, but an awful lot of its citizenry could be effectively weighed. In the written description for the show, I will once again reprint an article from ABC News from shortly before the election that showed that of prospective voters polled, 43% felt that Donald Trump was the more honest candidate. Only 36% thought that Hillary Clinton was the more honest candidate. That just goes to show you how far things have sunk. It goes to show you that an awful lot of the American people just could not tell a dirt road from a chicken with lips. It is bad news. And I think to understand just how far we have sunk as a country, reading from this book will give us a measure of what we have come to. I will be resuming with programs not only about what Trump is doing, what I call the Truppenkampfverbande, parts 11 and 12, will be recorded presently, but also a great many other things are going on as well. I will begin and end this program, as I have others, with a poem by Robinson Jeffers called Be Angry at the Sun. It reads, "That public men publish falsehoods is nothing new. That America must accept, like the historical republics, corruption and empire has been known for years. Be angry at the sun for setting if these things anger you. Watch the wheel slope and turn. They are all bound on the wheel, these people, those warriors, this republic, Europe, Asia. Observe them gesticulating. Observe them going down. The gang serves lies. The passionate man plays his part. The cold passion for truth hunts in no pack. You are not Catullus, you know, to lampoon these crude sketches of Caesar. You are far from Dante's feet, but even farther from his dirty political hatreds. Let boys want pleasure, and men struggle for power, and women, perhaps, for fame, and the servile to serve a leader, and the dupes to be duped. Yours is not theirs." Yep. Couldn't have said it better myself. We're going to plunge right back in where we left off in the end of For the Record 935, talking about Trump charities. Plunging right in that chapter, talking about Trump and, well, the way he, quote, gives to charity, unquote, which is the way he does just about everything else. I also think, just as I think that Trump University, which we talked about in For the Record 935, I think Trump's Monopoly-like board game, Trump the Game, also serves as a living sort of holographic metaphor for the U.S. We're all playing Monopoly, a Monopoly-like board game. We're all playing Trump the Game. And we will see just who turns out to be a winner. Jumping right in with David K. Johnston's text and chapter 16. Then there's Trump's Monopoly-like board game. When Trump and executives from Milton Bradley introduced Trump the Game in 1989, the developers surprised everyone by declaring these royalties would go to charity, too. Milton Bradley took Trump at his word. It also figured it might improve sales, which were weak, if people realized purchases would not enrich a presumed billionaire but go to charity. Its television ads told potential buyers, Mr. Trump's proceeds from Trump the Game will be donated to charity, unquote. Trump has said he made $808,000 and that the money was donated to his Donald J. Trump Foundation. A year after the board game was created, Trump made a deal with banks to avoid personal bankruptcy. It included a clause that put him on an allowance. It was a big allowance, $5.4 million per year to support his lifestyle, including a $100,000 limit on gifts to charity in the first year. At the time, I spent a day calling New York and New Jersey charities to find any disclosures of gifts made by Trump. Years earlier, I had created America's first hard news beat covering charities and trained the original Chronicle of Philanthropy news staff, so I was in a position to know many people in this sector. But call after call produced nothing. Finally, one professional fundraiser told me that Trump had been asked to buy a table at a charity dinner, and Trump asked for a discount, which was declined. These days, Trump calls himself an ardent philanthropist, unquote, but there is almost no public record that he has made much in the way of charitable gifts, and certainly not gifts in line with his claimed wealth of more than $10 billion. In 2016, reporter David A. Farenthold, F-A-R-E-N-T-H-O-L-D, used the same approach I tried a quarter century earlier, calling more than 200 charities in search of gifts by Trump. He identified only a single personal donation by Trump in the 7 years before he became the Republican nominee for president. It was a gift of less than $10,000 reported in 2009 by the New York City Police Athletic League, and it may have been recorded as a personal gift by mistake, Farenthold noted. Trump is not even the largest donor to his own foundation. The family that owns the World Wrestling Federation gave more since 2006. The Donald J. Trump Foundation tax filings show only a single gift from its namesake. It was for $30,000. The major donors in recent years have been vendors doing business with Trump. They offer gifts that can reasonably be viewed as a kind of legal kickback by the vendors of Trump pies and other products and services sold with the Trump name. Having contributions made this way would also be tax-wise if, as reported elsewhere in this book, Trump pays little or no income tax, thanks partly to special rules that allow major real estate holders to report zero income for tax purposes. While charitable gifts are tax deductible for someone who pays taxes, to anyone with no taxable income, that deduction is worth noting. Trump often encourages others to give, especially during his campaign, mixing partisan politics with charity, despite Congress making that an absolute no-no if the charities participate. The record shows that Trump makes little or no effort to check out the veterans' organizations he associates with, just as he has often failed to make even minimal inquiries into some of his business partners and associates. In September of 2015, Trump boycotted one of the Republican primary debates because Megyn Kelly, a Fox News personality, would be the on-air host. Trump instead went to the battleship Iowa, now a museum at anchor in Long Beach, California, to deliver what his campaign said would be a major address on national defense. Trump praised the sponsor of the event, Veterans for a Strong America, and told the audience that, quote, hundreds of thousands, unquote, of people belong to the organization. There were evidently two related organizations, both nonprofits, though Trump and his host never made that clear to the audience on the ship or watching on television. One was a charity, the other one of those dark money political groups that have expanded since the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision, enabling money from undisclosed sources to influence elections. A quick internet check would have revealed to the Trump campaign that the IRS had revoked the nonprofit status of Veterans for a Strong America due to their failure to file required disclosure reports. A charity disclosure organization, GuideStar, reported that it had no record of any board of directors. Every indication pointed to Veterans for a Strong America being a one man enterprise run by a South Dakota lawyer named Joel Ahrens, A-R-E-N-D-S, whose operation was under investigation for suspected election improprieties in Arizona and Texas. Reporters later learned the organization had $30 in the bank and debts 10 times that size. None of this was in line with Trump's promotion of the group's immense size, influence, and good works. But the nature of much of Trump's declared charitable giving is far from the only illusory aspect of Trump's life. He also has imaginary employees. I'm going to skip the next chapter. It's relatively well documented. Among Trump's many delightful inclinations is calling up media institutions and people and representing himself as being someone else, and then going on to disclose, quote unquote, all sorts of things about himself while pretending to be someone else. And now he is pretending to be he's not pretending anymore, is he? He is the president-elect of the U.S. And appropriately enough, in Chapter 20, we read about, quote, collecting honors, unquote, the title of the chapter.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com. Also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
David K. Johnston writes, Trump International Golf Links, a breathtaking seaside course in Aberdeen, Scotland, advertises itself as the world's greatest golf course. That boastful description does not come from Trump. Not exactly, anyway. When the links opened on the treeless dunes in 2013, the American Academy of Hospitality Sciences bestowed the honor in a ceremony near a windswept tee. Trump, wearing a red baseball cap, khakis, and a windbreaker, grinned as he posed with Academy President Joseph Cinque, C-I-N-Q-U-E, who wore a blue suit for the occasion. The two men held aloft a gaudy, gold-colored plaque declaring that the Trump Links was the only golf course in the sport's country of origin to be awarded the coveted six-star diamond award. The American Academy of Hospitality Sciences holds its honors in very high esteem, calling its Star Diamond Awards, quote, the most prestigious emblem of achievement and true quality in the world today, unquote. At the 2014 Mar-a-Lago New Year's Eve party, Cinque presented Trump with the Academy's Lifetime Achievement Award, evidently the only time the Academy has selected someone for this distinction. In all, the Academy has bestowed at least 19 of its 5 and 6-star diamond awards on Trump's golf courses, Trump Tower, a Trump restaurant, the Trump Taj Mahal Casino Hotel, and Trump's Mar-a-Lago Resort in Florida. Citing them as stamps of the finest quality, Trump uses these, quote, very prestigious, coveted, unquote, awards to encourage people to spend their money at his resorts. But these awards are not nearly as hard to win as even a single star in the Michelin Guides or a strong rating from Zagat. Michelin, the French tire company, employs teams of undercover restaurant inspectors whose identity is concealed even from top company executives. Michelin awards are so highly coveted that chefs who manage to attain 3 stars are said to have contemplated suicide at the prospect of being reduced to just 2. 1 star alone can result in a restaurant booking all its tables months in advance. The American Zagat Guides, meanwhile, gathered the impressions of thousands of diners to evaluate the quality of restaurants, hotels, cabarets, and even golf courses. The American Academy of Hospitality Services employs neither secret hospitality investigators nor popular opinion. Instead, the American Academy of Hospitality Services awards are chosen, according to the Academy itself, by its board of trustees. For years, those trustees included none other than Donald J. Trump himself, who held the title Ambassador Extraordinaire, unquote. Trump's distinctive signature appears on the Academy's plaques alongside that of President Joseph Cinque. In Aberdeen, Trump was accepting an award from a board on which he was a member. The ties between Trump's organization and the academy that finds his properties and his person so worthy of accolades run deep. A majority of the trustees bestowing these awards on Trump and his properties were Trump's employees, friends, or retainers. Recent trustees include Ivanka, Trump's oldest daughter, and his son, Donald Jr. There's also the chief operating officer of the Trump Organization, Matthew Calamari, and the general manager of Trump's golf course in Bedminster, New Jersey, which itself received a 5-star diamond award from the Academy. Another trustee was Anthony Senecal, S-E-N-E-C-A-L, Trump's longtime butler and recent historian at Mar-a-Lago, who posted on his Facebook page in 2016 that, quote, pus-headed, unquote, President Obama again quoting, should be hung for treason, unquote, and that President Trump would, quote, put an end to the corruption in government, unquote. Senecal, decked out in formal butler attire, including a bowler hat, proudly posed for a picture pointing his umbrella at one of the diamond awards given to the Florida resort at which he works. In his role as ambassador extraordinaire, Trump also bestowed awards. With Cinque at his side, Trump gave Knicks basketball forward Amari Stoudemire a framed, gold-looking plaque in the Oak Room of the Plaza Hotel in 2010. The award bore the engraved signatures of both Trump and Cinque. In a 2009 video tribute, Trump praised Cinque, saying, "There's nobody like him. He's a special guy," unquote. The year before that, Cinque was one of the judges at the Trump-owned Miss Universe pageant. Beyond having a board stacked with trustees that no one could call objective, another unusual aspect of the American Academy of Hospitality Sciences is its president's career in the hospitality industry. He has none. Cinque is known by other names. One is Joey No Socks. Another is the Preppy Don. If those sound like names that might be associated with a figure involved in organized crime, it's because they are. New York police, with a search warrant, knocked on the door of Cinque's Park Avenue South apartment in 1989. Cinque declined to let them in. The police applied a battering ram. Inside the apartment, they found a trove of stolen art, including two Marc Chagall prints valued at $40,000. They had been taken in an art gallery heist. Cinque made a deal to plead to a misdemeanor, but prosecutors scrapped the plea bargain after Cinque was seen talking to John Gotti, the dapper Don who became head of the Gambino crime family by arranging the murder of his predecessor, Paul Castellano, one of the secret owners of the company that supplied concrete for many Trump buildings. Gotti told Cinque that he would, quote, take care of the DA, unquote, an apparent reference to Ann Heyman, H-E-Y-M-A-N, the prosecutor who had offered the plea bargain. Writer John Conley, a former New York City police detective who wrote many revealing articles about Trump, mobsters, and corruption in high places, broke this story in New York Magazine in 1995. Heyman ordered a more thorough investigation of Cinque. She alleged that the investigation showed that Cinque, quote, was dealing drugs out of his apartment and fencing stolen artwork, unquote. Heyman also said that Cinque's apartment on Central Park South appeared to be a retail outlet for stolen clothing, including Armani suits and silk shirts. In 1990, Cinque pleaded guilty to a felony receiving stolen property. Cinque described himself very differently in an interview with Connolly, an interview in which he channeled Trump. He bragged about his prowess with women and described his rich new friends. Cinque admitted that he had associated with the wise guys, unquote, in his salad days in what he called the wholesale used car business, unquote, but said he gave that up after he took three bullets as the victim of a robbery. Cinque lifted his shirt to show off his scars. The police suspected the scars came from a failed mob hit. Cinque said that experience changed his life. He decided to go uptown and hang out with, quote, Muffy, Buffy, and Biff. These trust fund preppies needed someone like me to keep them out of trouble, unquote. Hence the moniker, the Preppy Don, unquote. In addition to whatever stolen goods, fencing, or drug dealing Cinque may have been involved with in Manhattan, He established a Midwest connection when he became executive director of the American Academy of Restaurant and Hospitality Sciences in Milwaukee around 1985. The group described its honors as the Academy Awards of the restaurant industry, unquote. A number of well-known restaurants declined to hang these honors on their walls, especially after word got around that the way to get an award might just involve a $1,000 initiation fee and annual dues of $495. Later, the headquarters moved to Cinque's Central Park South apartment, rebranded as the American Academy of Hospitality Sciences. After Trump announced his campaign for president, questions about his association with Cinque rose again. Cinque declined to accept calls from reporters. The Academy's lawyer threatened to sue anyone who made mention of Cinque's criminal history. Trump employed a different tactic. He told the AP that he hardly knows Cinque. They have posed together many times in many places. The former Joey No Socks says he's attended Trump's Mar-a-Lago New Year's Eve party in Palm Beach 14 years in a row. And what of the fact that Trump was listed on the Academy website as Ambassador Extraordinaire and Trustee just weeks before announcing his presidential bid? Trump said it was meaningless that he had never attended a board meeting. As for his children and employees being trustees, Trump said, "I don't know that anybody goes," unquote. After reporter Hunter Walker of Yahoo News asked about that connection, the Academy took down that portion of its website. And what about all those awards? Does Trump have any concerns that his signature is engraved next to that of a convicted felon? What standards does Trump apply in accepting awards, especially considering renowned Manhattan restaurants like Le Cirque and Le Bernardin declined to put the plaques on their walls? "If a guy's going to give you an award, you take it," Trump said. As for Cinque's criminal history, he said, "You don't tend to look up his whole life story," unquote. Joey No Socks was not the only man with a criminal past and shady business practices with whom Trump associated himself again and again in the years just before his 2016 run for the White House. There was also a convicted stock swindler who once served time in prison for driving the stem of a margarita glass into the face of another man in a lower Manhattan bar. And in chapter 21, we find out more about that.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
This chapter, Who's That? Months after Donald Trump delivered his profanity-laced remarks on the virtues of revenge in Loveland, Colorado in 2005, Rocky Mountain News real estate reporter John Rebchuk, R-E-B-C-H-O-O-K, interviewed him briefly about projects he was known to be considering in Denver. Rebchuk also questioned Trump's nappily-dressed traveling companion who had stood backstage during the tirade. He said his name was Felix H. Satter, or Satter, S-A-T-T-E-R, and he made it a point to carefully spell it out with two T's. Before Trump, his wife and Satter got into a limo for the hour-long ride to Denver, Satter said Trump would be visiting the Denver Union Station redevelopment site. Satter obviously had an intimate familiarity with Trump's intentions. Only the day before, Trump had said he had no plans to inspect the site. At the time, Rebchuk thought nothing of the way the man spelled his last name. All he knew was that Satter was closely associated with Trump's plans in Denver. Sacher's name appears with just one T in a host of places. There's the deed to his home, for example. It is also spelled with only one T on New York State court papers from his 1991 felony conviction for stabbing a man in the face with the stem of a margarita glass. The name Sater, or Sater, S-A-T-E-R, with one T, also appears on federal court papers in a $40 million organized crime stock swindle he confessed to in 1998, a scheme that benefited him as well as the Genovese and Gambino crime families. The stock swindle involved fake stock brokerage firms using high-pressure tactics to get naive people to buy worthless shares from Sater and his mob friends. The extra T, Sater later explained, was his attempt to conceal his past from people making simple internet searches where his criminal history would be easily spotted. No doubt Sater was also less than eager to have people in banking and real estate investments figure out that his father was a reputed Russian mob boss in Brooklyn. Any effort to obscure his past ended in 2007 when real estate reporter Charles V. Bagley wrote a long New York Times article detailing Sater's criminal history and other dealings. Donald Trump, the Trump Organization, and Alan Garten, G-A-R-T-E-N, the general counsel, have all said that they check people out before doing business with them, a standard practice in business and a vital one for deals involving large amounts of money borrowed from banks and individual investors. Yet, until Bagley's article appeared, Trump and his lawyers say they had been unaware of Sater's criminal history. Instead of severing ties with Sater, however, Trump continued to associate with him. Sater worked for Bayrock, an investment firm involved in Trump Soho, a luxury high-rise in Lower Manhattan, as well as a luxury high-rise on Florida's Atlantic coast that was to be called Trump International Hotel and Tower Fort Lauderdale. The Florida project failed. Curiously, Sater had no job title at Bayrock, whose offices were in Trump Tower. When Sater left Bayrock, he moved into the Trump Organization suite of offices also in Trump Tower. In 2010, 3 years after Bagley's article appeared, Sater was issued business cards by the Trump Organization. His title was Senior Advisor to Donald Trump, unquote. When people who had made advance purchases of condominiums in the high-rise found out about Sater's past, they filed a 2009 lawsuit against Trump and others. One of the issues was an alleged failure to be candid and forthright about who Sater was. The buyers asserted that failing to disclose Sater's criminal connections up front was a violation of the duty to inform them of every material fact that could influence their decision to invest or walk away. The suit, one of two over that project, also alleged that the whole high-rise endeavor was a classic bait-and-switch con job fostered with false advertising. The investors claimed that they had bought in only because Donald Trump was the developer. It was supposed to be a quality Trump property, and they were willing to pay a premium price to invest in a building bearing the Trump brand. They later found out Trump had only licensed his name. The civil racketeering suit also accused Sater of siphoning millions of dollars out of the project, harming the buyers, while simultaneously hiding these proceeds from tax authorities. It was an accusation with more than a hint of the stock swindle that Sater had participated in, which the FBI said had benefited him, the Genovese and Gambino crime families, and others. Joe Altschul, A-L-T-S-C-H-U-L, a Fort Lauderdale lawyer representing 75 of the early Fort Lauderdale buyers, said his clients would never have deposited millions of dollars for their apartments had they known about Sager's criminal history. Purchasers had a right to know who they were dealing with, Altschul said. It's bad enough that they prop up Donald Trump as a developer, but then you find out it's not Trump, but a convicted felon who had already been charged in financial shenanigans, unquote. According to Altschul, had Sager's past been disclosed, his clients, quote, wouldn't have touched this deal, unquote. Trump, under oath in the Fort Lauderdale lawsuit, expressed a different view, saying the failure of the project was actually a boon to the buyers. Quote, on this one, they got very, very fortunate that they didn't put their money down, that they didn't buy the units, and that would have been worth a fraction of what they were worth when they signed at the all-time high in the market, unquote, Trump explained. Lawyers for the buyers noted that other Fort Lauderdale area condo projects at that time were completed and had done just fine. The 2009 lawsuit involving Trump International Hotel and Tower Fort Lauderdale happened to coincide with the sentencing for Sager's stock swindle. Sager had pled guilty in secret in 1998. Many of the court records of that case remain sealed in the federal courthouse in Brooklyn. For a file to remain largely sealed after almost two decades was so unusual that a retired federal judge, the Miami Herald, and others went to a higher court to get the records opened. It took a United States Supreme Court order to finally unseal some of the Brooklyn files in 2012. Among the files that were finally made public was Sager's guilty plea to a felony charge in 1998. The files also included his 2009 sentencing, no jail time. Despite Sager's violent criminal past, he got probation plus a $25,000 fine. Aside from the relatively insignificant fine, there was no requirement that Sager pay back a cent of his ill-gotten gains. There is every indication that the extraordinarily lenient treatment resulted from Sager playing a get-out-of-jail-free card. Shortly before entering his secret guilty plea, Sager became a freelance operative of the Central Intelligence Agency. One of his fellow stock swindlers, Salvatore Luria, L-A-U-R-I-A, wrote a book about it. The Scorpion and the Frog is described on its cover as, quote, the true story of one man's fraudulent rise and fall on the Wall Street of the 90s, unquote. According to Luria and the court files that have been unsealed, Sager helped the CIA buy small missiles before they got to terrorists. He also provided other purported national security services for a reported fee of $300,000. Stories abound as to what else Sager may or may not have done in the arena of national security. Without a doubt, Trump continued to be involved with Sager in business. In 2009, when the Trump Soho opened in Lower Manhattan, video cameras captured Trump, microphone in hand, extolling the virtues of that project. Two men stood with him. One was Felix Sager. Yet when the AP asked about Sager in 2015, Trump said, Felix Sager, boy, I have to even think about it, unquote. Earlier, under oath in videotaped testimony in the Florida case, Trump said he would not recognize Sager if he were in the room. Other statements Trump has made under oath make it clear he knew about Sager's involvement with the CIA. The real problem for Trump and what prompted him to distance himself from Sater was liability for civil fraud in the Fort Lauderdale real estate litigation. The stronger the connection that the buyers in the failed project could establish between Trump and Sater, the greater the damages they stood to collect from Trump. Trump making money from deals and then distancing himself from individuals he was involved with in those deals was not limited to the lawsuit over the failed Fort Lauderdale project. As we shall see, it also came up in litigation over deals in Hawaii, Mexico, and Tampa. It is interesting, too, parenthetically, that Trump is involved with real estate and obviously some very shady dealings. It was, of course, the highly duplicitous housing market, the real estate market that brought the global economy down in 2007 and 8. And now we are all, I guess, playing Donald Trump the game.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
I think the last chapter we're going to read from this book, because there's a lot more to cover about Donald Trump that isn't in this book, and an awful lot more that's going on. Chapter 22, Down Mexico Way. The sales pitches urged investors to get in early to reap the biggest profits. The Trump Organization, Donald himself, and two of his grown children announced that, along with a firm called Irongate and some other West Coast partners, they would soon transform a sleepy little spot on the Pacific coast only a dozen miles from the California border into the next hot Mexican vacation spot by building the Trump Ocean Resort. The Trump.com website listed Punta Bandera, B-A-N-D-E-R-A, which means tip of a flag, as a Trump portfolio property, one of 33 Trump Organization projects in development, unquote, around the globe. A video and brochures touted the twin waterfront towers that would soon go up. Two of Trump's children flew to San Diego to mingle with would-be buyers. "We are developing a world-class resort befitting of the Trump brand," Ivanka said in a video between pictures of the Pacific Ocean, the beach, and renderings of the planned waterfront apartments. "We're really creating Northern Baja as the new Cabo, as the new resort destination," unquote. She was referring to Cabo San Lucas, the once quiet Mexican fishing village at the southern tip of the Baja Peninsula, which, following the construction of waterfront hotels, now bustled with American tourists. "This is a deal with my brother and, of course, our father, with the whole strength of the Trump Organization that we are extraordinarily bullish on," Ivanka continued. "Proximity to San Diego makes this a tremendous investment," unquote. Trump himself appeared in the video as an authority on luxury development, saying, "I am very, very proud of the fact that when I build, I have investors that follow me all over. They invest in me, they invest in what I build, and that is why I am so excited about Trump Ocean Resort." Prospective buyers were given a frequently asked question sheet. One question: "Tell me more about the developers, the Trump Organization, and Irongate," unquote. Ivanka Trump told sales reception attendees that she was so impressed with the project that she was buying one of the apartments herself. She chit-chatted with prospective buyers, saying that once they became neighbors, she just might drop in to borrow some sugar. Her brother, Donald Jr., also told prospective buyers he was buying his own pad as well. The Donald Trump name and the assurances of his children attracted prospective buyers aplenty. Many paid a $5,000 deposit for an exclusive priority reservation agreement, unquote, required just to hear a sales pitch at the Grand Hyatt in downtown San Diego. The payment was fully refundable to anyone who decided not to take advantage of the opportunity. The prospect of getting in early on a transformative project, and one in which buyers might run into the next generation Trumps, was so attractive to some people that they were neither put off by nor dubious of the high-pressure sales tactics. Much later, three people who had made exclusive priority reservations complained that they were given 5 minutes to buy or walk. That didn't even give them enough time to read the terms of their purchase contract, much less consult a lawyer. They signed, writing checks totaling more than $200,000. Some buyers later said they put their life savings into their eagerly anticipated new homes by the sea. They came to regret being so hasty and so trusting. Nearly 200 people bought in, putting down more than $22 million in deposits in 2006, confident that the project was about to get underway and that before long, they would move into their beachfront property and enjoy the security of a smart investment in a Trump-developed resort. A June 2007 newsletter notified buyers that construction was underway. The next month, the Trump Baja News reported, quote, "Our new and excited homeowners now are part of an elite group of vacation homeowners who own property developed by one of the most respected names in real estate, Donald J. Trump." 3 months later, in October, when Wall Street crashed under the weight of toxic mortgages and other Baja real estate projects faltered, the same newsletter carried a message, quote, "From the desk of Ivanka Trump." Ivanka assured the buyers that their investment was sound. Quote, "Though it may be true that some of Baja's developments could slow down, these market conditions simply do not apply to Trump Ocean Resort or any other Trump development," she wrote. 2 months later, in December of 2007, the newsletter advised buyers of newly discovered geological problems afflicting the building site. A few months later, in March of 2008, anxious buyers received calls or letters. Construction loans had been approved, would be funded shortly, and the work would be underway. This was 9 months after buyers had been told in writing that construction had already begun. Still, construction did not proceed. All of these promotions, sales pitches, and the newsletter updates created the impression that Trump was the builder and the developer, words he used personally and explicitly. The buyers later said they bought in because Trump was the developer or builder. That understanding then changed abruptly. The worst news arrived 2 days before Christmas 2008. What had previously been described as a partnership between the Trump Organization, Donald J. Trump, unquote, and the other people and companies involved was described in a new way. Neither Trump nor the Trump Organization were investment partners in the Trump Ocean Resort. They were not the developers either. They had merely licensed the use of the Trump name. The actual Baja developers, it came out later, had obtained authority, unquote, from Trump to use his trademark name in return for an upfront fee. Under that licensing agreement, as testimony and court papers show, Trump gave the actual developer authority to tell prospective buyers that Donald Trump was, quote, developing, unquote, the Mexico resort, even though he later testified that he was not. The losing buyers soon filed a host of lawsuits in California asserting fraud and collectively demanding the return of their $22 million plus lawyers' fees and other costs. The three people who faced the five-minute deadline to buy or walk away said that in their 2010 court complaint that they went ahead only because Trump was the developer and had his own money in the deal, a belief strengthened by the statements that Ivanka and Donald Jr. were also buyers. Their lawsuit listed the Trump Organization first among the 13 parties accused of California state securities fraud, simple fraud, negligent misrepresentation, accounting fraud, and unfair business practices. In time, most of the lawsuits were consolidated in Los Angeles. The suits were revised and revised as new facts emerged until the fourth amended version of the complaint ran to more than 640 pages. It was filed on behalf of well more than 100 buyers. The lawsuit detailed by name, date, and event each specific act of alleged deception used to get people to invest, a packet that lawyer Daniel King said was meant to make sure there was no doubt about how pervasive the acts of deception had been. In court papers, Trump distanced himself from the Baja deal. He insisted throughout that he never owed any obligation to the Baja buyers and had done nothing wrong. He also declared under oath in those cases, "I personally do not have any employees in the state of California, own real property in California, or maintain an office in California," unquote. Trump, in fact, owned real estate in California, employed people in California, and indeed had offices there. For years, he had owned and operated his golf course on the Palos Verdes Peninsula in Los Angeles County. Testifying in a Florida federal court where other buyers had accused him of fraud in a similar waterfront condominium project, Trump was asked to name all the properties he owned. "Trump National Golf Club, Los Angeles, I own that," he testified. The crucial word in that California sworn statement was "personally," unquote. Trump did not own his California properties personally in the sense that most homeowners have their own names on the deed. Trump owned the golf course and employed people through a corporation under his absolute control. Trump's lawyer at Trump's National Golf Club in Los Angeles was included on the list of people served with every document in the Baja litigation. Daniel King, Bart Ring, RING, and other lawyers for more than 100 of the buyers eventually made a deal with one of the Trump parties to pay back more than $7 million, a third of the buyer deposits. The Trump side objected that the deal was unfair to them and would leave them, quote, holding the bag, unquote, for the other $15 million of deposits plus costs. Trump's lawyers told the judge that his family and businesses never touched those deposits. The problem, they said, was that the actual developers did not have enough capital to complete the project. Trump's lawyers accused the real developers of misusing the deposits for personal gain by extinguishing personal debt guarantees related to the Trump Ocean Resort project. The license to use the Trump name, the Trump side pointed out, specifically prohibited Trump and his organization from doing any sort of developmental work. It barred them, quote, from even inspecting the property on less than 24 hours' notice, unquote, and required them to not interfere with the operation of that property, unquote. Quote, "People who gravitate toward luxury brand name products do so because they expected superior quality and design, Trump's lawyer wrote. They do not, however, believe that the designers are doing the dirty work, unquote. Furthermore, the lawyers wrote, while the buyers claimed that they were tricked into believing, quote, that the Trump parties were the developer of the project, the buyers, quote, could not have believed that Donald Trump would be on site in Mexico overseeing construction or collecting their deposits. More importantly, the Trump lawyers continued, the license to use the Trump name, quote, was disclosed to the plaintiffs when they entered into their contracts, unquote, and in the statement of how the condominium would be governed. Trump's lawyers made no mention of testimony from buyers that they were given just minutes to sign the purchase and other documents, leaving no time to read them or ask questions about the several pages of arcane legal details. The only duty the Trump parties had, their lawyers wrote, was, quote, to ensure that the standards of design and quality with the Trump name were met, not to grade soil, dig ditches, or collect deposits, unquote. Trump, his organization, and his two children settled with the buyers. The court sealed the terms of the settlement. Trump had been through all of this before. A 2006 press release described Trump as co-developer, unquote, of the Trump International Hotel and Tower at Waikiki Beach Walk and a partner, unquote, in the project. Reporters were told that the winner on Trump's television show, The Apprentice, would be project manager overseeing development for Trump, unquote. Trump boasted that the combination of his name and Waikiki would be setting a new standard of luxury, unquote. In late 2006, he bragged about, quote, the biggest one-day sale in real history in the world, unquote. When buyers signed contracts totaling more than $700 million for 464 apartments. Nearly 3 years after his successful one-day sale, when buyers were due to make the final deposits on their apartments, they received a brochure titled Trump Waikiki Life Owners Edition 2009. On page 23 of the brochure, in what a lawsuit later described as microscript that can barely be read without a magnifying glass, unquote, people who had already signed sales contracts received troubling news. The Waikiki Tower bearing the Trump name in which many had invested their life savings, quote, is not owned, operated, developed, or sold by Donald J. Trump, the Trump Organization, unquote, or any affiliated business. Trump had merely licensed his name. Hawaii state law, like California and federal securities laws, protects buyers from false and misleading sales pitches. Hawaii law this requires disclosure of all material facts to buyers. Trump's status as a mere licensor was obviously material to making an investment decision based on the supposed value the Trump name would add to the building. But the licensing was not the most disconcerting fact that had been hidden. Long after they had made their deposits and signed contracts, the buyer discovered provisions in the Trump naming license that could jeopardize the future value of their apartments. Trump had reserved the right to take his name off the building. According to Trump's own statements, it was his name on the building that made the apartments so valuable. Without it, the apartments would be worth much less. Furthermore, if Trump ever withdrew his name, he was free to put it on another building, even one right next door. This was crucial information to buyers looking to make a smart investment. The lawsuit called this conduct unconscionable, citing more than 20 material facts that it said were improperly hidden from buyers. As with the Baja fraud suit, a settlement was reached and then sealed by a judge. And in another Florida case filed over a never-built Tampa high-rise, buyers finally obtained a copy of the licensing agreement under court order. The licensing agreement stipulated that its very existence was to be kept secret, not just the specific terms of the agreement, but the existence of a licensing agreement in general. The agreement indicated that a Trump business was paid a $2 million upfront fee for use of the name. In testimonies, Trump has named 14 properties that are straight licensing deals and three others in which he also gets some profits or is a partial owner. In the Tampa case, Trump was asked about disclosures in other licensing deals. "Do you, sir, or your company disclose to those buyers that you're merely licensing your name?" a lawyer asked. "I think in some cases we do," Trump responded. "I am just not sure." Another lawsuit was filed over a Fort Lauderdale hotel and apartment project that at 52 stories was to be the highest tower on the Florida Atlantic coast. Those buyers received a sales brochure with Trump's picture and the statement, quote, "It is with great pleasure that I present my latest development, Trump International Hotel and Tower, Fort Lauderdale," unquote. Buyers also got hardcover books that announced on the first page a signature development by Donald J. Trump, unquote. The project failed, and buyers wanted their deposits back. At trial in 2014, Trump testified that he had never claimed to be the developer and had no liability. The word developing doesn't mean we're the developer, Trump said. The civil jury agreed. One of the buyers was still pursuing an appeal when this book was completed. That concludes For the Record program number 936, The Making of Donald Trump, subtitled Top Banana Republic, Part 5, being recorded on December 1st, 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.